It's Thursday, June 19th, 2014. This is the Hermetic Hour. I'm your host, Paul Runyon, and tonight we present a discussion on the English translation of Secret Practices of the Sufi Freemasons by Baron Rudolf von Sombodendorf, first published in German in 1924. The translation is by Stephen Flowers. This is a highly controversial book by a notorious author. Sombodendorf was the founder of the Thule Society, which germinated into the Nazi Party. When he tried to take credit for that, the Nazis kicked him out of Germany and sent him back to Turkey. Now, how he managed to be a devout Muslim and a Nordic pagan at the same time is one of the many mysteries this book conjures up. Transcending his politics and his fanaticism, there is a very provocative and profound occult knowledge in this book, much of which is hidden even to European students until recently. We will compare Sombodendorf's revelations with Gerard de Nerval's Sufi version of the Masonic temple legend and P.B. Randolph's discovery of a Syrian love cult, which may have been the original source of the OTO's ninth degree. So, tune in and find out how the Sufis get a grip on themselves. This book is remarkable. I've been trying to find it and find an English translation of it for quite some time. And Stephen Flowers has done a very, very fine scholarly and inspired job of translating it and annotating it, introducing it. And, in fact, I can't praise him enough for the work he's done on this, because this is a very, very, very important book. Now, before we get into exactly what the book is, it's naturally we need to talk about Sombodendorf himself and his life. And this is a sort of a, well, kind of a sinister Indiana Jones here. Baron Sombodendorf wasn't originally a baron, and he wasn't originally a Sombodendorf, but he was born in 1875, and he went to, in 1900, he went off to Australia to prospect for gold, and then he returned to Germany in 1901 and got married and divorced, and then he went off to Istanbul, Turkey, and he really resonated with the Turks, and he was quite successful in Turkey as an engineer and one thing or another. And he got into, when he was in Turkey, now, by the way, I need to say that he was an ardent and a very astute astrologer. And this, he already had this under his belt by the time he got to, Turkey. But then, in Turkey, he managed to get himself in with a, if you can wrap your mind around this, into a Jewish Rosicrucian who was a member of a Sufi group. And apparently this Bektashi order of Sufis was very eclectic, even to the point where some of these Bektashi groups even took in Jewish people and Christians and whatever, the main order didn't, but some of them did. And Turkey, we need to say that at this time, Turkey was really a remarkable phenomenon in the Islamic world. They were they were moving, even before World War One, they were moving toward the West and trying to become what we would call a cosmopolitan nation that could get along with the West. And so their Sufis, the dervishes, the whirling dervishes, their Sufi orders were very, very eclectic. Now, we're going to discuss Girardi Nerval's Queen of the Morning, the Turkish version of the King Solomon, Hiram Abiff, and the Queen of Sheba temple legend, their strange version of the Masonic legend. And that sprung up in Turkey and was collected by the French member of the Hashashin and French literary figure, Girard de Nerval, back in 1841, which was, about 60 years before Spotendorf got on the scene. So we know that was already going back and forth from, perhaps it had originally originated in Europe after 1700, perhaps it did. And then it went back to Europe with Girard de Nerval. There was so much cross-pollination going on between the Turkish mystical groups and the European groups that it's very difficult to trace which came first, the egg or the chicken. We have a problem. I remember that I had a friend in Turkey who sent me a Dutch version of the Turkish minor arcana of the tarot, the so-called Mamluk tarot. And that actually does. It actually is the origin of the minor arcana of our tarot. Now, as we'll also discuss later, that Venice, as some of you have been watching Da Vinci Code, you're aware of this, Venice was really having a lot of intercourse back and forth with the Ottoman Empire and trade and everything else, and their alchemists were also quite interesting. The Arabian and the Turkish alchemists were corresponding with and interacting with the Venetian alchemists. And all of this is interpenetrated. Now, this is important to understand because Rudolf von Sobodendorf got, how he became a baron, by the way, he impressed this Sobodendorf family so much with his abilities and occultism and one thing or another that they adopted him. They adopted him into the family, and they made him a baron, and they gave him their name. So that's how he became a baron by impressing the Spodendorf family in Turkey, by the way. So here is this German adventurer here being taken in by and befriended by a Turkish Rosicrucian Jew who is a member of the Mektashi Sufi order. Now, okay, now if this isn't strange enough, what happens is that Sobodendorf, with his knowledge of astrology, of course, was an asset to the order and all of that, and he became fluent in Turkish, and so he actually entered into a practice in the order and under the direction of his Jewish Rosicrucian Mektashi Sufi master. He entered into a practice of what can only be described as tantric. I would describe it to myself as Sufi tantric masonry in which the chakras are activated, and it appears this is the part that is going to fascinate and also perhaps disturb some Freemasons who are completely convinced that that our Masonic signs, grips, and penalties of obligation are all completely original with us. They may not be. They might come from an earlier Eastern source, possibly, or it could be the other way around. We don't know. And we don't know who is, because, as I said, the Turks were interchanging so much material from the West, occult material, too. And not then, Sabodendorf isn't the only one who says this. Idris Shah, and I'm going to, one of our cross references tonight will be Idris Shah's The Sufis. And in case anyone has told you that that's not a good book on the Sufis, they're wrong. It is a good book on the Sufis. And the Sufis say it isn't because it reveals too much, and so therefore they don't want you reading it. But Idris Shah's book on the Sufis, the Devil Day one, the Anchor book, is very, very good. And he details quite a bit what Sabodendorf is really detailing in this book on the Sufi Freemasonries. He corroborates it. Shah corroborates it. Now, what we've got here that Sabodendorf is describing in this book is a system. It's a system of activating the psychic centers of the body, the chakras. And they do it with a series of grips and also sounds and signs that appear to be very, very much like Masonic signs and penalties of obligation. Now, I'm going to say that before I ever knew, way back when, before I ever knew that there was anything like this, either from Shaw and certainly not from Sabodendorf, which wasn't available then. When I first got into Masonry, I started doing this. I was immediately impressed that these signs of obligation, recounting the penalties of obligation, and they had to have some origin in the idea of psychic centers in the body. I mean, this is just it seems to be obvious. Because I was an occultist before I was a Mason. So this is one of the things I realized, you know, my gosh, you're standing between Solomon's pillars, between the two pillars. That means you're the middle pillar. And so here you are replicating the middle pillar exercise between the two pillars in Masonry. And this has obviously got to relate to spiritual areas in the human body. I knew that, and back when I was a chaplain in the Masonic Lodge down at the cathedral, I even wrote prayers about that, and I was able to deliver them in the lodge. Did this idea spring full blown from the mind of de Saguliers around sometime between 1700 and 17. So now, come on now. I think he got this idea from somewhere. One of the things that is a key to this is that the signs that Sabodendorf is talking about and that Shaw is talking about are very, very, very similar to the signs we use in Masonry. And so what are we doing there? Now in Masonry, I can't completely describe what's going on. Obviously, I'd be revealing Masonic secrets. But what we do in Masonry with these signs of obligation is that we say that these various areas of the body that we're making the signs on will suffer if we break our obligation. Well, all right, that's a very thinly veiled reference to psychic parts of the body rather than physical parts of the body, and it's a roundabout way of activating those same areas. It's just in reverse. But now what Sabodendorf is describing here for this Sufi exercise program, this Sufi Tantra, now he doesn't use the expression Tantra, but this whole process is so similar to Tantric Yoga that we have to at least mention that that is the real similarity to it. And one of the aspects that we have to consider is that we're doing this not only with the signs on the body, the grips. Now, in masonry, grips are different than they are here in this Sufi practice. In masonry, a grip is like a handshake. We have different grips for each grade or whatever. But in this system, the grips are laid on the body by the hands down down from the neck to the chest, to the stomach and down. And they're laid on in a symbolic manner where you actually touch and actually grip the body. Now, and you put pressure on the particular points. So, in a sense, this is almost like a martial art, in a way. It is a form of, I guess, it's a yoga. It's definitely a yoga. So, you have a regime, and the sounds that these signs are attributed to are finger in the air, index finger pointed upward, and that's E, and then the hand outstretched with the thumb forming a straight out angle. Ah, and then the thumb and forefinger forming a circle. Oh, E-I-O, Isis, Apophis, Osiris. Oh, yeah. The old Gnostic E-I-O formula. And that is the main formula. Well, that formula happens to be one of the most important formulas in magic, in Western magic. It comes all the way back from the days of the Gnostics in Alexandria. And we use it over and over and over again to indicate it's the Western, you could say in a way it's the Western version of Aum. And these are the three signs and grips, three main signs and grips of the Sufi Freemasons, if you want to call them that. Now, Simondorf calls them that. I don't imagine they call themselves that, but he refers to them that way because of the similarity. Now, one of the key aspects of this this battery or training program, which goes on for quite some time, and you work on each grip in sequence for a couple of weeks on each grip, and then you spend a lot of time on the next grip, and you keep working through this system. And you have a breathing regime that goes along with this, and you have the sound regime, and then you have a key to this, which is these so-called abbreviated letters at the head of the surahs of the Holy Quran. Now, these abbreviated letters are mysterious formulas, and nobody has ever figured out what these formulas really mean. There's a number of people who say they have, and different esoteric schools have different versions of what these secret formulas mean at the head of each of the surahs of the Quran. There, I think Crowley probably, whenever I spoke of Allah, he probably got his idea from the abbreviated letters of the Quran to have this mysterious cipher that nobody can possibly ever decipher. But these letters form the formulas that are used in conjunction with these special grips and sounds, and as you progress through this system, you activate these particular areas, sacred areas in your body. Now, one of the things they don't do, which of course Tantra Yoga, as you know, Tantra Yoga loads you down with interior visualization. It loads you down with it. and you actually end up projecting it. Whereas Taoist interior yoga, now these are what we're talking about, because we're comparing different types of interior yoga or interior alchemy, because actually Sabodinorf refers to this as, and he says that the Sufis refer to this as interior alchemy. Now, you know, the Taoists do too. And what the Taoists do is they activate these centers, and then they let you find out eventually what is in them. Now, energy comes first, visualization comes later. Tantric yoga is, of course, the other way around. You start building up these psychic centers within yourself, in your imagination, and then enliven them along traditional lines in your imagination. And then the energy follows that. It's just two different ways of doing it. In one way, you're pushing the cart, and the other way, you're pulling it. But it has the same result. Now, one of the aspects of this psychic center system, of course, that is really vitally important to us here in the West, is that this psychic center system lines up with Saturn up in the top of the brain, Jupiter in the third eye, and Mars in the throat, and the Sun in the heart, and Venus in the pit of the stomach, and Mercury in the navel, and the Moon in the central areas. This is the middle pillar. This is where the middle pillar of the Golden Dawn came from, too, by the way. It came directly from this. And in fact, Sabodendorf cites books in German, one of which I think Rigardi read before he did his Art of True Healing with the middle pillar. But Falcon, Dr. Falcon, he knew about this. And he put this in the Stella Matutina ritual. So this was known. And Sabodendorf, when he goes through this, I cannot emphasize this strongly enough, that what he does here is he lays this out in such terms that we know absolutely beyond any doubt this is the Western psychic center system. Now, I'm going to read you a little bit here from Sabodinorf's book. Because they are in constant flaming motion, the ancient Freemasons called them by the names of the seven planets. And if they use this terminology for other things as well, this only seems to be a contradiction. As I indicated, for the constitution of mankind, so too can individual constitutions be accordingly designated by the planets. Their relationship to each other is described by Abbot Johannes Trithemius. In the texts, we usually find the following schema, which is inscribed in concentric circles. I am representing it in another form because I wish to avoid symbols. Top, Saturn, pineal gland. Under that, Jupiter in the forehead. Under that, Mars, thyroid. Under that, Sun in the heart. Under that, Venus in the pit of the stomach. Under that, Mercury in the navel. Under that, the Moon in the sexual parts. The Sun is in the middle of the concentric circles, Saturn above, the Moon below. These chakras, or little flames, are nothing other than the organs of the spiritual body. The Benedictine Basilius Valentinius speaks of them in the following words. The king wandered through six cities in the heavenly firmament, but in the seventh he beheld his seat. Here, too, the investigations of Staudenmayer should be mentioned in his book, Die Magie de Experimentale, Weisskraft. And he proves that various nerve bundles can be specifically stimulated and special effects produced. We conduct spiritual forces to these easily stimulated places and thus build the spiritual body. Once the yellowish white is obtained, you transform this into a brilliant white by means of the master grip and the correct formulas. I choose with the word, I close with the words of Heinrich Konrad. With mine own eyes I saw the gold, not the common kind, but that of the philosophers. With my hands I touched it, with my tongue I tasted it, with my nose I smelled it. How wondrous is God in his works. Now, what he is referring to here is the psychic center system, chakra system, that we first see in the works of Jacob Bohm, and then we see illustrated in Jacob Bohm's disciple, Johann Gitchell. And this is the origin of this Rosicrucian chakra system, which comes down to us as the middle pillar exercise in the Stella Matutina of the Golden Dawn and Regardi's middle pillar, and which we, based upon these slender clues, we didn't have Sabotendorf back in 1973 when we first started to do this. We didn't have it. I looked at the middle pillar and I studied Tibetan yoga and I said we gotta extend this, you know, and so we started doing it. And we kept on perfecting it, thinking that we were, you know, didn't have any backup except Regardi's middle pillar, and the feeling like maybe this is going to work. Well, it turns out that what we were doing was what had been done for hundreds and hundreds of years, very, very quietly over in Europe, and also very, very quietly among the Sufis in Turkey and perhaps even further east than Turkey. Idris Shah, now, let's get a little further into this. I want to read what Idris Shah has to say about the psychic centers in here. The disciple has to waken five lata'if, receive illumination through five of the seven subtle centers of communication, the method presided over by the instructor, the Sheikh, is to concentrate the consciousness upon certain areas of the body and the head, each area being linked with the lata'if faculties. As each lata'if is activated through the exercises, the consciousness of the disciple changes to accommodate the greater potentialities of his mind. He is breaking through the blindness which makes the ordinary man captive to life and being as it ordinarily seems to be. In more than one sense, therefore, the activation of the centers is producing a new man. Lest the reader unconsciously link this system with others which may resemble it, we must note that the activation of the lata'if is only a very comprehensive development. It cannot be carried out as an individual study. The five centers are named the heart, the spirit, the secret, the mysterious, and the deeply hidden. Another one, strictly speaking, not a lata'if at all, is self, composed of a complex of selves. And this is the totality of what the ordinary man or woman considers personality. It is characterized by a shifting series of moods and personalities whose rapidity of movement gives the individual the impression that his consciousness is constant or a unity. It is, in fact, not so. The seventh subtlety is accessible only to those who have developed the others and belongs to the real sage, the repository, and the transmitter of the teachings. He goes on to say in another part of the book, Idris Shah does, that you can have the lata'if anywhere that you want to place them, but just as long as you are consistent and you are appropriate and consistent with what you were doing, what you were teaching, what you're doing. So In other words, what he's saying is that this is not necessarily the Hindu system. This does not line up. And by the way, let me make this very, very, very clear. Because when we get into the these letters, these abbreviated letters in the Quran that define this whole system, and by the way, you don't have to use those. I mean that the Sufis do, of course, but that's not essential to the Western system. In other words, we did that when this came over, and it's very possible this came over from the West. In fact, Swedenborg even says, he even indicates in here that this chakra system actually came over from the West. So who knows? Jacob Bohr may have been the instigator. Paracelsus didn't do it. I looked all through Paracelsus' writings, couldn't find any reference to it. Trithemius obviously, had something to say about it. He had, but Bohr apparently it was his original inspiration. He and Gitchell, and they may very well have influence, as we know from the way the Turks. And the fact that Swedenborg learned this from a Jewish Rosicrucian. All right, Bernardi was a Jewish Rosicrucian. All right, but somewhat later. So this could have come from the West, and in the East, or it could have been the other way around. But regardless of wherever it's been. Very quietly and very powerfully in our tradition and in the Turkish Bakashi Sufi tradition for a long time. And I want to point out, though, here, in case you're wondering about the order, because I want to get into explaining a little bit about the differences in this order and how this comes about. But there's one thing that really, really stands out here that I recall when I was going through Swedenborg's book here, by going down these letters, sacred letters in the Arabic alphabet, and they're down to Y, Yah, 1000, Kaios, Surah 19, the name of God is the Lord, and the cosmic correspondences are the first heaven, Saturn, and the abode of Abraham. Oh boy, yeah, Saturn, right there on the top. Now, that means that corroborates what Swedenborg is saying, and that corroborates what Jacob Bohm created and what Gitchell codified. That's the Rosicrucian psychic center chakra system of the West, from which the Golden Dawn's middle pillar derived is a shortened version, abbreviated version thereof. Now, this is very important because what happened, at a certain point, this fell under the veil of secrecy, and I think perhaps under the influence of the Theosophists and the impact of Woodruff's Serpent Power, and which is a fairly, Woodruff's The Serpent Power is a fairly accurate description of South Indian tantric chakra structure. And still is quite a good book. But that, under the influence of Theosophy and the Woodruff's The Serpent Power, the Western psychic center system, because it was secret and because it was the bandy about, it got overwhelmed with this Eastern system, which is pretty good. I mean, I'm not saying it isn't, but it got overwhelmed by that. And also, they made the mistake of thinking that Woodruff's chakra system, the Theosophists made the mistake of thinking, that that was the way all chakra systems were all the way over Asia, all the way into Tibet and everywhere else is not true. The Tibetans have a different chakra system for every deity they practice. But this Woodruff version of the system, and it is the main Bengali tantric system, and I'm not saying that Goswami's book Laya Yoga isn't good. It's wonderful. It's great. I've learned a lot from it, and I'm not saying this is wrong, and I'm not even saying that the Western version of it's wrong. It'll work, sure, it'll work, but for Westerners, our system works better, and our system is a great deal more powerful. As you will discover when you work the middle pillar, you'll get a lot more power out of just working the middle pillar, just a few chakras in the middle pillar. You'll get a lot more power and a lot more development, spiritual development out of that than you will out of sitting there and trying to do Bengali Tantra. Now, no kidding. I mean, if you don't think so, try it. Thousands of people have done the middle pillar exercise. And that's only a brief aspect of the Western system. That's an abbreviated aspect. Now, the difference between, and this also applies to the Sufi system that we're talking about too, the difference between these two systems is essentially this. The Hindu system brings power up from the earth and breathes power in with prana. Breathing power in with prana, we all do that. We do that in the east and the west. We breathe this power in. But what they don't do in the tantra, in the Hindu tantric system, what they don't do is bring power down from above. They do not bring spiritual power down. They do not come down through emanations. In the West, follow the Kabbalah, we follow Plotinus, we are of the Hermetic tradition. We bring power down from the stars. And we breathe it in, too. Don't get me wrong. Prana, or the power of the air, the life force in the air, that's very, very important. But symbolically and spiritually and through the power, tremendous power of our imagination, we bring power down from above. We bring it all the way down. We ground it. We bring it all the way down and out of loop. We ground it in Bria, and we bring it back up, and we open up the psychic centers, and we go inside them in Yetzirah. And we really don't go any farther than that, because Yetzirah, in turn, influences. That's the realm of the thought forms. That's the realm of the preforms, and that's where we do our magic to influence Ashiya. And that's where we do the influencing. Whereas, if you will check, you will find that the Hindu system is etheric. It's etheric. So it really doesn't matter. Your chakras can be in the Hindu system. We're not even worried about that. We'll come down through the dimensions of the Kabbalah using our divine imagination. So the two systems are not in conflict. The two systems are not working against each other. They're just two different ways of doing it. And the one that Sobotendorf is describing in this book is more Western than Eastern. It really is. And he says so. And he admits it. And he did. I need to say in this respect, I said that I was going to tie this in with the temple legend. And I think the good thing about that is we tie it in with the temple legend of Giardina Arvalo's Queen of the Morning, Queen of Sheba and King Solomon and Hiram Abiff, who they call Adoniram in the temple legend. I think we should tie this in because this is another example where masonry and Rosicrucian alchemy all tie in and actually come together in Turkey and then come back. Now, when I say that, way back before the 9/11, I had a Turkish friend, correspondent, Frater Regulus, and he was a Turkish Golden Donner, and he told me, he said, Bunk, he says, if you want to understand the gin, if you really want to understand the gin, he said, get Gerard de Nerval's Journey to the Orient. And so I took Prateragos at his word, and I went out and I got Gerard de Nerval's Journey to the Orient. And here, 1841, Gerard de Nerval, this French Hachachin, he committed suicide, hanging himself in a garter that he claimed belonged to the Queen of Sheba. I mean, this guy was really a romantic. But anyway, he had done the grand Eastern tour, like so many of the French decadents and Orientalists, decadent Orientalists, you know. So he did the grand tour, and he got up to Istanbul in 1841, and he sat in this coffee house in Istanbul and for 7 nights and frantically recorded, as in shorthand, obviously, this storyteller recounting in 7 chapters the story of the Queen of Sheba and the grand architect, who they called Adoniram, and King Solomon, in the casting of the Brazen Sea. And this was that great big laver on the back of 12 oxen out there in the front of the temple courtyard. And according to this story, the Brazen Sea was going to be Adoniram's most ambitious work, and he was going to cast it. And the Queen of Sheba was all, you know, she was, according to Islamic legend, she was part jinn, and so was Adoniram. He was part jinn, and Solomon was just a human being, and not a very, according to this version of the story, Solomon wasn't a very nice human being either. And Queen of Sheba was a lot smarter than he was, and she actually becomes enamored of Adoniram. And so Solomon starts getting jealous because she's more attracted to the architect than she is to Solomon. So the three ruffians that we're familiar with, three ruffians come to Solomon and they say, Your Majesty, we have an idea that you're not too fond of Adoniram. It could be that some of the spouts when he casts the Brazen Sea, and this might just ruin the whole project. And Solomon says, well, if that happens, I don't know anything about it. But if you fail, then I will know something about it, and you'll suffer, so don't fail. So anyway, so they plug up some of the casting holes and their spouts. And they have the great casting, the Queen of Sheba sees Adoniram, says, they've played, my casting has been sabotaged. And the Queen of Sheba says, dive into the hot molten bronze, my dear, and you won't be harmed. And so he died. He, of course, dissolves in a puff of smoke. But he manages to unclog the spouts, and he's taken down into the underworld and given all the secrets of the djinn by Tubal-Cain, who is, of course, Husarin Khasis, the Phoenician craftsman god. And then he's resurrected, and the key and the Queen of Sheba run off and make a monkey out of Solomon. So that's their version. That's their version, which, by the way, Rudolf Steiner adopted. Oh, see, the Germans like this sort of thing. And Rudolf Steiner adopted that. And so, and Manly Hall has a big painting of it, casting the Brazen Sea in his big book, Secrets of the Freemasonry and the Rosicrucians and whatever. So, that was the Turkish. That came out of Turkey. Now, I also mentioned P.B. Randolph. P.B. Randolph is another guy that sort of a forgotten man of modern magic. He was part black. We would call him a black man today, but in those days they called him octoroons, I think, or mulattoes. But anyway, he got in a little trouble teaching sex magic to wealthy white women, and that didn't make him too popular. But he was a terrific magician, and we owe a lot to P.B. Randolph, like flashing colors, that's P.B. Randolph. Fluid condensers, that's P.B. Randolph. Magic mirrors, well, modern magic mirrors, yeah, that's P.B. Randolph. But P.B. Randolph did a lot of traveling, too. He was a merchant seaman and like a world traveler. And he went over to Syria, and in Syria, he found a love cult that was goddess-oriented now. It was goddess-oriented love cult, and what they were doing was virtually what has come down to us as what's referred to as the ninth degree. It was, and of course you understand it, that Western sex magic, which is what we're talking about here, Western sex magic is very alchemical. It's not this transmutation of sexual energy into spirituality like the Eastern version. That's not it. So when Carl Kellner, the founder of the OTO, German, when he claimed that he had some tantric input, probably not. His input was Gnostic and quite probably from this Syrian love cult, which was primarily female-oriented. Now, this means that what you do is the man and the woman have a congrex, and then while they're doing this, they imagine the magical astral child of their lovemaking will accomplish a purpose for them, and then they have a talisman which they charge with the effluvium of their act, and that becomes their magical operation, very powerful, very very effective, but the way Carl Kellner ended up, and Theodor Roos and the Germans, and for a while there, I think Crowley too, the way they ended up doing it was completely male-oriented, and the woman didn't even want the woman to know what they were doing. So this wasn't the original at all. But the original probably came from P.B. Randolph, from this Syrian cult that he got into. And he called his system Eulus. But, you know, we don't hear too much about Randolph these days because, as I said, he committed suicide in his front yard. He had an argument with his neighbor and blew his brains out in broad daylight in his front yard, and that didn't help very much either. So we don't hear too much about Randolph, but Randolph was really, really quite a contributor. But here again, this all ties in this Turkish this Turkish Sufi aspect of the magic that we think of as Western, and it is, and also to their alchemy. They were very much into alchemy. One thing I'll say about Subotendorf's system with the grips and the signs. And his yoga that he's talking about, his Sufi yoga, this is very alchemical. And as far as they're concerned, they're making gold inside their own bodies, and the gold is the word. And the word is the words are golden, and the gold is transformed within them. This is very Jungian, by the way. And Subotendorf has several pages in there where he's revealing to his own on his own lights that alchemy in this sense is an internal process, that this is an internal process and this is a transformation process. But the main thing, as I say, about Subotendorf's book is that it totally and completely validates the Western psychic center system. Now, what happened to poor old Subotendorf? Well, left Turkey, came back to Germany, went to Switzerland, and he wrote up the Freemasonry of the Sufis, and he wrote up this little book, and he published it in Germany. And then when the Bolsheviks were really just about to take over Germany during the Depression, Subotendorf became fascinated. He always was fascinated with German nationalism and German folklore and German mystique. So he formed the Thule Society in Munich. Well, the Thule Society was kind of half political and half mystical and whatever. But what ended up happening was that a handful of people from the Thule Society got captured by the Bolsheviks and executed. And then they became martyrs, of course, and then the Thule Society became paramilitary after that and went out to get them. So the Thule Society was joined with some other people who just, the Germans really wanted communism, but they didn't want Russian communism, and they especially didn't want Jewish communism because, they, as far as they were concerned, the Bolsheviks were all Jewish, and unfortunately, a number of them in Germany were. But they were socialists. So this became very quickly the National Socialist Workers' Party. They were socialists, and Simondorf was one of the original founders, but it was very quickly taken over by Adolf Hitler, and Hitler, even though he was okay with socialism, he thought it would be a good idea to get the big corporations, that's the Junkers, of course, the big corporations on their side so they could have fascism instead of communism, instead of socialism. At that point, of course, Simondorf drifted off, and so Hitler took over, and then Simondorf decided he was going to write a book called Before Hitler Came. Before Hitler came, there was the Thule Society, and I did it. Well, he published this book. The Nazis didn't like it. Oh, boy, they didn't like it. So they ran him off back to Turkey. So he went back to Turkey, and he sat out the war in Turkey. And, of course, when Hitler finally committed suicide, Simondorf went out to a bridge over the Bosphorus and dived in and was never seen again. So that was the end of the Baron. But anyway, what a wonderful book he left us, and what a wonderful legacy. Even though, you know, as I say, out of some pretty bad things, some very, very, very wonderful things have arisen. I want to thank Stevens Flowers again for this translation. I've been looking for this book for years, and it's just really, this is just absolutely delightful, and I thoroughly recommend it. Next week, oh boy, next week, a forgotten man of magical fantasy, a man who influenced many, many people, including Lovecraft and Schaefer, the man who took us down into the vault and down into the caverns beneath Narmadol to visit ancient Lemuria. Abraham Merritt next week, and don't miss that one. So we'll see you then, and until then, good magic.